Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am really honored to be joined today by Ishmael Beya. He's the Sierra Leonean and American author of the novel Radiance of Tomorrow and the memoir A Long Way Gone, which was a number one New York Times bestseller and has been published in more than 40 languages. A UNICEF ambassador and advocate for children affected by war, Beya's latest novel is called Small Family. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary.
This book is so beautiful, and one of the first things that struck me in meeting these five characters you write about who make up this little family is that none of them have backstories, that the past traumas don't even feel like they need to be discussed. It's just all implied. Tell me about that decision.
Well, you know, I believe that, you know, firstly, I think when people are struggling, and these characters sort of live in the edges of society, and I think people who are at the bottom of any stratification of society don't necessarily go around thinking about their background or their past. You know, they kind of want to survive. They kind of want to do things in the immediate period of their life so that they can deal with what's coming. But equally importantly, I believe that as human beings, when I was thinking about how I did their characters, and I thought it'd be too heavy-handed to have all of their backstory. But I also know that how we behave in the present says a lot about our past. So if I was to sharpen their behavior in the present, you will be able to understand their past without me having to give it to you. And also, when I write, I trust in the intelligence of my readers to draw some imaginative conclusions about certain things without me kind of tying it up for them.
Yes.
And what has been really interesting is that when some people read it and I ask them, you know, did you mind? And they say, no. I was like, what would you think Eleman, for example? What do you think his background was? And most people usually think what I had thought when I was writing Eleman, by the fact that he reads a book when they're trying to struggle and he reads it with ease, says a lot about how he grew up and who he is. So I just find it was a more useful technique to get to the story itself rather than giving you all that. But that's what people are used to traditionally. Give me the backstory and
right.
then I'll feel empathy for the character. But I think you can feel empathy for the character just how they behave in the present. You know?
Absolutely. And the novel is so much in the present. And as you were saying, I mean, so much of it is about survival. And I imagine that when that's the case, there is no past or future. There's just now.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the family and how they communicate, because they're like they could pull off a heist in some other in some other novel, but they're so clever, and they also I feel like they really are generous with each other and each other's emotions. So tell me all about that.
Well, when I was creating them, these five characters in Little Family, I was trying to look at, first of all, not to have the traditional sense of family, in the sense that if you have been ostracized from various ideas of family, when you find the people who are kind of your heart connection, understand certain value or moral system, your closeness is going to be much deeper than even your blood relations, right? Mm-hmm. And therein lies the equity itself of how you treat each other. You know, you're going to, because you've already had mistakes of how you've been part of family. So you cannot come prepared.
Right.
So I brought these characters together who have disbelieved in belonging to something, but then they found that each other and this became their new family. And they also have to be useful to each other. So the way they also have to survive was not to show people that they are together, because they did
right.
not want to be found. And therein, I wanted to build a sort of a communication mechanism so it's not obvious to the naked human eye, or the person who's perhaps naive about certain things looking at them would not know that they're together, but they'll be able to communicate. So they communicate through a series of whistles, hand signals, and, you know, movements, walking left or right, or certain ways that they've all talked about and determined this is how they what they will do. you also realize that they're very deep observers of human beings. So because they need that to survive. And this was really important to me because often intelligence is ascribed to people who are maybe at the top of society in terms of socioeconomic status. But intelligence is universal. It belongs to everyone. Just because you're not in a certain space doesn't mean that you're not as dangerous. So I wanted to show their intelligence, even in the space that seemed broken.
Yeah.
That you require intelligence to actually more so to live in broken places than when you live in functionality, because other people can think for you, you know.
And it's one of the verbs I was struck by in this book is they used the word corrupt to mean to steal. And that to me says so much about the setting.
Absolutely, because, you know, they're trying to have this conversation. You know, the little family will go to this place where it's called a night market, whereas usually where in the book I brought all these characters who are at the edge of society who come in at night to exercise a true form of freedom or just to be around each other without having to worry so much. Mm-hmm. It's a place for them to relax, but it's also a place where they have social commentary on society and what's going on. They listen to radio, they watch grainy televisions, they do all kinds of stuff. So the conversation really comes about the fact that they're thinking, listen, in this unknown country that they live in, when politicians steal, they are considered to be corrupt. But if they steal a cup of rice to be able to survive, they're seen as thieves. And so they're basically taking their own agency. And yes. Again, fairness, and be like, well, we would no longer be called thieves because actually we are taking something to live, but people are taking it who may not need it. So then it becomes a new word added to their language, which is that, hey, I corrupted that watch or I corrupted that bread, you know.
And, yeah, and there's a great line where Elamin says something like, they were already on the crooked path of history, so why walk straight?
Yeah, it's a question to ask. If you grew up, it's about if you grew up in an environment where things are broken, it takes a certain kind of moral foundation to be able to do the right thing, right? Because every time you do it, you have a lot of people who are not doing it. So then you become actually broken by that sort of idea that we are each other's keepers. If that doesn't exist and you try to practice it, you become the odd one out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they argue the fact that, well, by participating in this, aren't we furthering this very idea that we have ostracized ourselves in society from by doing so? So they kind of explore whether that question is, yeah. You know, how you function in this place where you have competing ideologies of who you are and as you're forming yourself, and how do you really, is there a win? If it is, what is the shape of it, you know,
right.
And what does it say about who you are as a person when you
mm-hmm.
come out of it?
Tell me a little bit about the decision to not name the country that they live in.
Well, I wrote this book in various countries and in various capital cities, mostly on the African continent, you know, but also even here in the United States. So for me, it was more that if I name the country, it limited the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel that the characterization and these characters, versions of them exist everywhere in the world.
Right.
For example, right now in COVID times, everybody has had to form their own little family.
That's
to stay indoors.
Sure.
Whether it's you and one person or you and your dog or whatever it is, you've had to live with, you have to create that bond to survive. And I felt that this is a very essential human activity that we do when we are faced with circumstances beyond our imagination, right? We create a bond or we seek something somewhere. And I feel like if I'd named a specific place, and again, the reader's imaginative capacity only stays there.
Right.
But for example, some people have thought, oh, this could be in Zimbabwe, or some people have thought this could be in Baltimore, and some people have thought, so everybody sort of have had their own remembrance of similar situations, which then makes the story theirs. Because that's also for me, when I write, I want to hand over the story to the reader so it becomes theirs, not just to invite them into it and then they leave, you know. So that's kind of the technique.
Yeah. Tell me about this family. Their one of their survival skills is their invisibility. Tell me about how that liberates them.
Well, when you're invisible in any structure, then people don't expect anything from you. So then you have all the space to be free. Right? people don't think about it that way. Those at the top in power think that, you know, you're at the bottom, you don't have the intelligence, you don't even have the ears to hear certain things. So they will speak around you about really, you know, private information or important information,
right,
that they may not think you have the capacity to actually understand, but yet you're there, you know? So this is their power. Their invisibility becomes their power in the sense that they pay so much greater attention to things. Nobody expects anything from them. So they are left alone most of the time to do what they want to do.
Yes.
And this larger society thinks of them as incapable of doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so they really can operate. Which also questions what society is, that are you really free when society pays attention to you and restrict every single natural impulse that you have?
Right.
Or are you free when society ignores you so you can then exercise those natural impulses to do whatever you want? So, but there's a moment where Kudimata, one of the main characters, is trying to befriend the beautiful people who are the affluent members of the society they've ostracized themselves from.
Yes.
And you see how she has to put down that cloak of invisibility to be able to function in their world, you know, and how that made her feel exposed to certain, in a certain way, as she was learning to embrace this new life, you know.
Absolutely. You do such a good job of writing about how Kuri feels scared about looking too beautiful, revealing her body or her clothes and her beautiful hair, and leaving herself open to danger.
Mm. You know, this specific character, really, I wanted to... you know, I've witnessed moments, you know, that really pushed for me to write this character the way I did, where, generally speaking, this applies anywhere in the world, most women, young girls or women, are always tied between, you know, taking care of those they love and themselves. And oftentimes they take care of those they love and forget themselves. Mm. So when I was writing this character, I was going to write a character that would not do that, because I have two daughters. And I don't want them to grow up to be those kinds of women who would make that decision. If anything, choose yourself as a woman, because the world is so masculine in every way you think of it, that you shouldn't have the burden of fostering that space for the masculine behavior in a way. And I remember my daughter was about a year and a half old. We were in Senegal. And we're on a boat, and these guys who were sitting away from us were saying that, we know she's a girl, but why don't they pierce her ears so we know she's a girl? And that really upset me a lot, and that fed into the writing of the character, where I believe that the man doesn't have absolutely no space to decide how a woman expresses herself in any way, you know? And so that really fed into me wanting to write this character as this young woman who will become herself unapologetically. In her own way, and so, you know, and which is really important to me to see and to change the way even men look at. But it was a difficult character for me to write. Obviously, I'm not a woman, so but I had to, and I knew that I had my own, you know, blind spots, perhaps even the Grand Canyon as a man, you know. And so I wanted to really, so I had to learn a lot. I had to consult women in my life, my wife, for example, who's my first reader and my editor, who's a woman, to really be harsh with me. I had to even learn about how to speak about a piece of clothing for a woman. Mm-hmm. Because when a woman wears something, there's a way she feels it, as opposed to mine. We are functional, most of us. We wear functional clothes. We like it, but it's not going to make us feel a certain way. You know what I mean?
Right.
Most men don't. Not all, but most men don't. But for a woman,
I know some exceptions, but
some exceptions, yes. But for a woman, it means a lot more. So I wanted to get all those layers intact. So I had to also, you know, remove my own masculine POV to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's a testament, I suppose, to her intelligence and charm that she is able to pass, quote unquote, with these more well-off youth.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but that's also the other thing, right? If you are at the bottom of, or you've removed from any established order, you have a duality that most people don't have, right? The duality being that you've lived in that established order and you enter it and leave it. Whereas the people who are at the top of it only stays there. So they have one POV, but you can actually go between the two worlds very quickly. And that requires a certain level of intelligence, a certain level of reorganizing your morals and kind of shifting between two worlds, you know, and having that capacity, that multifacetedness of who you are, you know, in a way. So I really wanted this character to be that and to master it so well that she functions in either world, but she carries each within her, you know.
Yeah, and even the logistical concerns for her, you do so well. Like there is a place where she needs to keep her more fancy clothing, or there are places where she needs to sleep at night so that she can't, so that her family doesn't see her in disguise.
Absolutely, you know, there's an in between where she has to, you know, remove the mask of one world to enter the other, you know, fully. And she always does this back and forth, and which is can be exhausting for her, but slowly she begins to find out how she wants to live, really. And in the opening of the book, I mentioned that when she's at the market, that every day she has to decide how to remain suspended between being useful or being destructive, right? So you kind of see that play out in the entire book where she's making those choices, but always to remain in between. So she also has the freedom, because that's what really the question, the concept of freedom is choice. Yeah. You know, the ability to make the choices you want, you know.
And some of her freedom also comes from just carrying a knife with her.
Yes, I mean, there is, she's a realist in that
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
She's not a naive, because her world, she's seen things, you know, so she doesn't have, for example, the friends that she made with the beautiful people with Mawa. Mawa is fierce in her own way. She has her own personality. She'll cross the street without looking and stop the cars. but she's also naive in some sense, because she cannot see certain things.
Right.
She cannot see how wounded the world is in a lot of ways, which she brings to the table. So she sees certain things. She sees menace in men in a way that Mawa may not necessarily see, because she has a kind of naivety. But she's grown up in being protected. You know, life hasn't really broken her in the way that it has broken Kudimata. But Kudimata is able to put that on hold, but also still function in their order even better than Mawa, because she can see those things.
Right.
Yeah.
I was struck by how, if you think holistically about the novel, there wasn't that much violence in it. There was some, but the threat of it was there all the time.
Well, I mean, what I was trying to really imply is that, you know, everywhere you live, particularly if you live on the margins of society, there's always a background of something that's not good, but that background doesn't stop you, you know. Again, you're not walking around and thinking, oh yeah, it's so dangerous here. Oh yeah, it's dangerous here. You know it's dangerous. So it no longer becomes an obsession. It becomes that this is a situation, but how do I live through it? It's kind of what's going on in COVID now. We're all in lockdown. If you spend your day thinking that, oh, there's a COVID out there, there's a, you know, there's something out there, you're going to drive yourself crazy. You know, so basically you get on with your life, try to do certain things within the limit of what's going on, right? So in a way, I wanted these people who live in environments that have the backdrop of something really massive, and not necessarily thinking about it all the time. They're aware of it, but they are not. It's not an obsession, because they have to live. You know, you have to continue living regardless of the situation, you know.
Yeah. And even just, I was struck by the descriptions of food, because food is a primary front and center thing in their lives when they're trying to survive.
Yeah. But, you know, as in everybody's life, food is very
That's true too, especially in COVID.
You know? Exactly. Food is instrumental. Food is also says a lot about who you are, and people don't realize it. It says a lot about your upbringing. It says a lot about, you know, what part of society you are in. You know, you find certain people who would think McDonald's is a restaurant. That kind of gives you the backstory of who they are, right? So, you know, so I wanted to play, but in this particular context, because it's an unnamed country that has a colonial burden, it also comes with the heritage of this idea of supremacy of values or thinking, in the sense that if you go to certain restaurants in your country, you cannot have your own food. You have to have foreign food to seem sophisticated. So this is also a question I wanted to explore, because this is a very real thing that happens in most post-colonial places. If you were to go to Italy, you would not be given Sierra Leonean food all over Italy, right? And asked to, if you want pasta, then people have to fight you for it. You know, you know, that would never happen. But on the flip side, it happens. And so I wanted to explore, what does it say about the very people that are playing in this? Even if they're sophisticated and smart and intelligent, what does it say about their intelligence? How, you know, how does it fall short? You know, or what are their blind spot, or what have they not thought about it? And so I wanted to explore this. You know, but even within the context of food itself, where Kudimata used to eat before is very different.
Yes.
From where you eat. She even makes fun of the descriptions on the menu about this and that, because she was saying that where she eats, if you talk about food this way, they would think you're a comedian, because the food is either good or it's not good. You know, right. You don't have to make all these gymnastics about it, you know.
Tell me a little bit about what you've been reading.
I'm always reading. When I'm writing a novel, I usually don't read because I don't want to be influenced by anything. So, mm-hmm. But besides that, I always, you know, when I used to teach writing and my students would ask me, how can I be a good writer? Or some of them would say, how can I be a famous writer? And I would say, you know, how many books did you read this month? And they would say, well, I'm not reading. And I said, well, you know, you're not going to be a good writer. Mm-hmm. If you're not reading, you have to be more of a reader than a writer. So I read a lot. What I've been rereading a lot of few things that I've read before, you know, in these times, just to you know, I've gone back to read a lot of Albert Camus, who is one of my favorite writers. I've been
very
reading,
relevant here.
Absolutely. I know. I was actually told by a bookstore that most people have been buying The Plague, that they, you know,
yeah.
Albert Camus, The Plague, like everything's just flying on the shelves, I guess, you know. So years later, I still, you know, so this is why reading is important, you know?
Yes.
So I've been reading some of these things. I've been reading also Naguib Mahfouz, who's an Egyptian writer. Wrote Children of the Alley and various other works, so I've been reading some of that. There is a Zimbabwean writer that I've been reading as well. His name is, he wrote The House of Hunger, and his name is, his name just escaped me.
I will look it up.
Last name, I think, is called, not Sisi Ndangaremba, not Nervous Conditions. It's another one. I can't remember his name, somehow it just escaped me. But anyway,
that happens.
And I've also been reading a lot of Italo Calvino, who's an Italian writer as well, sort of magical realism, things like that. Yeah. So, and Edwidge Danticat, who's also one of my favorite Asian writers. So I've been rereading a bunch of stuff, you know. And there are some other things that are on the horizon coming out that I'm looking forward to reading as well. So.
That's great. Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.